Welcome to MetaStrategies, a forum on world-class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Colin Boyd to the broadcast. Colin's the Chief Information Officer of Johnson Controls, a multi-industrial company with annual revenue in excess of $40 billion that operates in the automotive interiors, automotive battery, and building systems marketplaces. As CIO, Colin's responsible for the entirety of the IT function, including managing an expense budget in excess of $700 million, with IT staff throughout more than 80 countries. Prior to joining Johnson Controls in 2008, Colin served in a variety of leadership roles for Sony Ericsson, including Chief Information Officer for Sony Ericsson from 2001 to 2008. Colin has a bachelor's degree in production engineering from the University of Nottingham and a master's degree in information technology from the University of London. I recently caught up with Colin at his hotel in Washington, D.C., and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, people, as Colin described the process of assembling strong teams, Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed the process that he used to learn Johnson Controls business and develop his plans there, as well as a variety of other topics. Boyd, welcome to the forum on world-class IT.
Thank you very much.
Colin, I thought we'd begin with your current role at Johnson Controls. You are the Chief Information Officer of the organization. For those who might not be familiar with Johnson Controls, can you talk a bit about the company and your role in it?
Sure. So it's a 125-year-old company, long established in Milwaukee, still in Milwaukee. The origins of the company were in building systems, so HVAC, heating, ventilation, air control. The company has diversified in recent times. We now have three or four major lines of business. We run an automotive interiors company, so that's the parts of the car that you sit in and touch as a passenger or a driver, the seats, the door panels, rather than mechanical. We have our battery business, both traditional lead acid and lithium ion. And again, that's predominantly in the automotive market. And then the originating business is building HVAC systems, and we've expanded into lighting and security, so we can do full technology fit-outs on buildings. They range from small individual retail outlet to an Olympic stadium, full-scale range on the buildings. Then we also have a facilities management service for the buildings. So again, we will run it as well as install it and build it. And that business is obviously a mixture of refurbishment of existing as well as fit out of new. So those are the main lines of business we run. We, to scale it for you, it's about 170,000 employees, so over 100 countries. We network to about 1,500 locations, and the turnover is kind of 40, 45 billion range.
And your role as CIO?
Role as CIO, head up the IT for the company. Each of our business units has a head of IT, and we have a matrix structure for them. They report to me and also to the CFOs in their businesses. They're primarily responsible for the applications that are unique to each of those businesses. And we have centralized teams that run the applications that span the whole company, plus the infrastructure, security, procurement, and project management. It's largely centralized, but because we have three separate businesses in three very different markets, their application portfolios are unique to them. We keep those teams close to the business rather than trying for full centralization.
And how have you thought about the balance between those things that become standards for IT and those things where the divisions, the business units have authority or autonomy to make their own decisions?
It's really a cost versus speed and response decision. Obviously, if you're going for minimized costs, you probably would centralize, and then it's a ruthless standardization. We've done that on infrastructure, standard PC hardware, software, network equipment, and so on. So in the infrastructure space, very standardized and centralized. There's very little maneuvering room, should we say, for the businesses in that area. Procurement is centralized too, so is security, and we run an enterprise PMO, so again, to enforce common project standards. The problem for a company like us is when you're so big and global, more than 50% of our revenue is from overseas. So to think that you can be close to your business and close to the customers if you're sat in Milwaukee doesn't work. You have to find that compromise of making sure that you're responsive to those business units around the world. We keep local IT presence within the business units. they effectively are our BRM function. They do account management to the business and then do application support. It's finding the right balance really between standardization and local flexibility. And being honest, it's a constant gray area, and we dance around, and sometimes somebody standardizes when they probably didn't need to, and vice versa. So you just try and find the right balance between giving the businesses flexibility and standardizing. The total elimination of skunk works, I don't think, is actually desirable. So we all hate it in IT when a business runs their own skunk works. But I think as long as there's it's a smaller controllable level and they don't impact security, that's probably not a bad thing. But I think, you know, it lets them move fast, and probably faster than they can if they're involved in the IT function and we're trying to do global solutions for everything. It just needs to be a moderate, controllable amount, but I don't actually aim for zero, just something small.
This company and others, I'd like to get into more detail in some of your past employers. Common thread through your career is technology, engineering-centric organizations, where your colleagues outside of IT often have deep technical skills, just as your colleagues inside IT do as well. Speaking first and foremost about Johnson Controls, what is it like? How does IT work with the engineering depth, the technical depth of the rest of the organization? How do you weave yourself into those conversations where in many cases they are as technical as your own team is? In the balance between the advantages of never having to explain to them that technology is so important to the organization while also having a group of peers across the organization who are, as I say, deeply technical, how do you weigh those sort of blessings and, I suppose, maybe not curses, but that come along with that?
Oh, no, I think there's a few curses that come with blessing. It's interesting, you know, historically IT is more aligned to finance, and that goes back to the mid-60s and the very first, commercial computerized applications, you know, being ledgers. Today, the most challenging user group for a typical company would be the engineers. The R&D and the engineering is where the higher level of cost and complexity is. The good and bad, of course, the engineers tend to be somewhat capable in the IT arena, so they are quite happy to come and build one of their own servers to their own standards. So it's a wrestling area. It's usually one of the main security areas because, again, full standardization, control, lockdown of the machines is probably difficult. The interesting thing, I think, for many companies is that we're moving from supporting the engineers in the creation of the product, which we've been doing for a while. We've had the CAD, CATIAs, PLMs. I think most IT companies are now getting involved in the actual product itself. I think one of the expressions for missiles is fire and forget. And I think products in the past were kind of sell and forget. But when you look at it now, you know, we see a future where maybe not the car seats, but everything, the big building chillers and the HVAC systems, many of the things that we sell will remain connected back to us post-sale. So the jargon, I guess, being the Internet of Things. But that means that as an IT function, we have to connect with the engineering guys in order to make sure that the product sold can then be supported in the future. So again, you know, you're looking at predictive maintenance being built into the controllers now on HVAC systems. So we've had it in IT probably since the mid-1980s. But already, you know, more and more products have that connect back capability with cheap IP connectivity. I think that's a game changer for the IT departments. You're actually intimately involved in the product, subsequent service of the product. So I think that's a big change. And that's going to keep us very close to the engineering departments.
And I suppose it also means that there's that much more of a need to have a team who can speak as true peers to the engineering community within your organizations, perhaps in a different way, how the business is done, how one's colleagues outside of IT are not as deeply technical in those industries where that's not the case. Yours has to be a team who can meet your colleagues halfway in order to have the credibility to get more involved in the development of products and services and so on. Is that right?
Yes. And people move, that boundary is more fluid than the others. HR don't tend to hire my IT guys and vice versa too much, but on the engineering, they move. You know, they have people who are as competent as we are, if you like, on IP networking and connecting devices in networks. We have to be competent in their world. So I've got IT guys who can design shuttles. So it becomes a much more fluid boundary, and people move from side to side. So it's probably a much tighter relationship there than some of the other areas where it's more a traditional service provider. In engineering, yeah, the boundaries are blurring.
You joined Johnson Controls roughly 6 years ago. For our listeners, they will notice you do not have a Wisconsin accent, despite the fact that you live there now. So you came to the U.S. your first time living here, at least, 6 years ago. You joined a new company at the same time in a new industry. So there was a lot to learn. You add to that the complexity of arriving 2008, which everyone will remember was not the greatest economic year for our country or any country, really. There was a lot to learn culturally, industry-wise, company-wise, while also grappling with the challenges of a time that was trying across industries, particularly acute in the industries that you serve, the industry that you're involved in. I wonder if you can take a moment to reflect upon the ways in which you made it through those early challenges in order to establish a solid footing within the IT department at Johnson Controls.
I'll comment at one of the management meetings from the CEO was, you know, so we've had sort of 60 years of continuous unbroken profit and growth, and then you joined, Colin. I hope he was joking, but it was actually true. I mean, I was clearly hired as a deliberate outsider. So they were clearly not looking for somebody who had 20 years in the buildings in HVAC business or from automotive. So they were picking someone, if you like, with a fresh set of eyes, different viewpoints. Most of my previous years have been in consumer electronics. So did I know the business or have the background in it? No. Diverting a second on that one, it does raise the interesting topic about the transportability of IT. My view is that IT is a specialization. And, you know, a competent CIO, it will take you some time to learn a business, and for me, it did. So I think, you know, people warned me that you're going to be drinking through the fire hose for a year, and it was true. But I think, you know, it's more realistic for a CIO to be able to learn a new business than it is to be able to take a lawyer or a communications or a marketing or any other area and say, right, you know, we're going to make you an IT specialist. You won't do that in a year. But I think as a CIO, if you're competent, you can learn a business in a year. Not enough to lead it, be a CEO, but in terms to be able to understand it and support it and be able to align your IT strategy with it, yeah, you should be able to do that in a year. So mine was slightly different. We had a little visa problem to begin. So I was very restricted in my first year in my time inside the US, which seemed a problem at the time, but it certainly had benefits. It made me really focus the time I was allowed in the US to use that to best effect. But it meant that the remainder of the month, I was really kind of doing my own personal roadshow. So by the time I moved to the US, I was a lot more familiar with a company abroad, and let's just say many people in Milwaukee. The weakness was obviously learning the head office capabilities and the functions there due to limited time. That was the immediate requirement to learn that company and make the relationships with the individuals. It was a challenging first year on the road full time, basically. But you do learn a company. You do learn that the view from headquarters is not necessarily the reality out there in the provinces. So I think it served me well in terms of being able to take a global view on things once I did finally move to the US. You know, I've never been accused of being Milwaukee-centric. The accent hasn't changed. Supporting the Packers is mandatory, of course. So you're not given any options there. So some bits of Americana are obligatory. Yeah, you can't say the word bears. That's just no good. And obviously, if you buy a motorbike, there's only one brand you're allowed to buy.
Right, Harley Davidson.
Yeah. You learn the culture of the company. I think you pick that up pretty quickly, and the tone is set from the top. So once you know, Steve Roll was there in my day, you set the tone. So you pick up the culture, and then you have to learn the company business. And getting out there and visiting plants is what I'd been doing for a year. So I had a good bottom-up view. And then you just have to adjust to that cultural shock of moving from the UK to the US. Obviously, the language is not a major problem. There's a few little interesting mistakes we made. It's really just learning how things work. How do you buy a car? What do you have to register it? What do you have to do with the number plates? How do you find a dentist? What's medical insurance? What's that? It's just different. I'm not saying anything better or worse, it's just different, and you just have to learn the mechanisms for living. How do you shop, do all the basics in the new country? But luckily, that was when my wife led the way in that area. My job was to learn my way around JCI and learn the business. But I think the key point is, you know, I do believe IT competence is transferable across companies and industries more than people think it is. You know, you can go to an automotive company or a pharmaceutical company, and you know, you can be a successful CIO without having 30 years of industry experience. It's can you really run IT with the complexity and the size of the company. That's the challenge.
Can you talk a bit about some of those early plans, the early strategy that you set for yourself, and perhaps bring it through to today as to some of the things you're working on now?
The other plus and minus, I guess, in my early days was no one was pressing me immediately for, okay, what's the IT recovery plan? In 2008 and 2009, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen anything move so fast. But we were genuinely, I think, along with most of corporate America and Europe, in a survival mode. Just for background, you know, the automotive volumes in the US, typically 16 million units. And I remember sitting in meetings with, well, it can't go below 15, can it? And then you're looking at 14 and a half, and then, well, it can't go below 14. Next minute, it's down to 12. It was just constant disbelief, and it almost reached a point where the automotive companies couldn't forecast. They had no idea what it was going to be next week. The first early days were just really support that survival effort, planning, you know, and you're hoping you're going to come out of the bottom of a recession, that, okay, once we get past this, and hopefully we come out of it in a position where we have an ability to invest, what are the areas? Johnson Controls was a victim of its own success in terms of IT. The company had enjoyed spectacular growth for about a 15 to 20 year period. And it had done a lot of acquisitions, a lot of growth, a lot of acquisitions, and the IT had kind of struggled to keep up. So it wasn't really structured for a 40 billion company. It was structured more in the 5 to 10 billion. So the company's growth had outpaced IT, would be a good way to put it. And with the range and the number of acquisitions that happened in the Atmon M&A, again, we hadn't managed to keep up in terms of consolidating and rationalizing. And that was typical for the building industry. So I think there was a York acquisition, I think, around 2005-06. But it wasn't one company. From an IT footprint, you were acquiring a company that's equally had 50 years at M&A. You were acquiring IT platforms for multiple companies. And we were ourselves and Johnson Controls in the same position. It was an IT turnaround and recovery. It wasn't that IT had failed. It was just really hadn't kept up. The infrastructure had to be updated and standardized. PCs upgraded, moved, put them up and now to Windows 7, just updating infrastructure. Infrastructure was patchy. There were parts of the company where advancements had been made and others where it hadn't. So it was bringing everything up to a common standard. The application base, again, mixed bag, too many. It needed rationalization, needed upgrading. And then cloud was just beginning to happen. So these were in the early days of the Microsoft Azure platform. Salesforce were a young and upcoming company. Workday probably at that time hadn't been formed. So there were clearly, when we were trying to come out of the recovery and work out what to do, it was a little bit of an infrastructure first, build the platforms, we integrated data centers, rationalized them down, brought them all to common standard, implemented common operations team. So honestly, most CIOs listening to this, yeah, routine stuff. Most of us have been through it, blocking and tackling. We put the platforms in place that we could run global applications. Most of the businesses were evolving as we came out of a recession from regional structures into global structures. So if you like, the automotive going from a Europe, Asia, and America into, let's have a global seating business, a global door frame, door panel business, and so on. So again, there was a drive in IT that we had to get global platforms rolled out across the company. We spent a lot of time in the businesses, and we did talk to them in the depths of the recession. We had to make it very clear that, yeah, we know we're focused on survival first, but we're still planning for what's going to come out on the other side of this. We pulled the IT strategy together. A lot of work had to be done on prioritization. So many things to do. What was the sequence? What were the urgencies? And obviously, there was a degree of unknowns at the time. The businesses were not quite sure what the world's going to look like at the end of this, but you know, we had to make some calls and assumptions. So when we came out of that, we had a recovery plan for IT. And essentially, we've been trying to execute it ever since. It's obviously an evolving target. And you know, the maturity of cloud platforms, as that's increased in the recent years, I'm not talking now about 2009 and 10, that's given us an incentive to move. So we now have three major cloud platforms in the company with Microsoft, Workday, and Salesforce. We're still running core ERP platforms, and we're consolidating those down, so that traditional work's continuing. And then we've got the innovative areas around engineering, mostly. You talked earlier, the internet of buildings, as we would call it, so that work's still taking place. The B big data pilots and operational now. It's really trying to get IT where it needs to be for the company. We did have to move the cultural view of IT. In the past, being honest, very much a cost center orientation. So demonstrating value is a constant challenge, but it's something we've placed an increased focus on, the value of what we do. And the industries we operate in are extremely cost conscious, especially automotive. Everything you do has to be cost efficient. I'm not saying it's cost down is all that we do, but you have to be very careful about where we do invest, very tight controls to make sure we don't let any of the cost structures put us in an uncompetitive position in the markets. Because you really can't carry anything in the way of overheads in the automotive industry. It's very tight. So we have to make sure that we can keep the company cost competitive while at the same time taking them forward. I guess every CIO will say this, but I think we're pretty good at doing a lot with a little. I doubt there's a CIO listening to this, anyone in the world, who isn't equally challenged to do more with less. For us, that secret is, yeah, it is standardization and centralization, but we haven't gone fully down that path. I think we've got the balance about right.
Some of what you've described in those early days, especially in taking an organization as you described that had the IT department appropriate for an organization an order of magnitude smaller in terms of revenue, just as a proxy there. A lot of what you had described was standardization, developing as few processes, as few applications, as few layers of infrastructure as you possibly could. The irony of that is oftentimes there's a period of greater spend in order to achieve the cost savings on the tail of those activities. You were making the pitch to do so at a time where dollars were much tighter than normal. What was the process of developing your analysis and pitching that analysis to your colleagues in order to give them the confidence that, if I may assume, that it did in fact mean perhaps an increase in some areas, while no doubt you were finding other areas to cut costs, perhaps to reach an equilibrium of sorts. Was that a challenging conversation in order to make that argument?
Oh, yes. The expression shock and awe brings to mind. I think when I was hired, they knew they had issues. They knew IT wasn't where it needed to be. I think there was an awareness of, yeah, we're a bit behind. I know the finance leadership would often go to conferences, you know, and IT is on the agenda in finance conferences. And I think there was a degree of, discomfort when they're kind of learning where some of the peer group is at with their IT and a growing realization, okay, we've got a bit of a problem here to deal with. So there was probably no surprise when I said to them, guys, we're going to have to up the level of investment here to address some of this. The timing was obviously not good. Candidly, at that point in time, like many other companies, you know, we were forced into plant closures and layoffs. So when you're going through that trauma, to have one part of your mind working on that and the other on, okay, yeah, but we've got to invest for the future, yeah? Timing and communication and messaging was definitely difficult. You had to be very sensitive to go and tell some guy who's had to lay off a bunch of people and close a plant that, you know, we're going to have to spend money down here in the future. Difficult conversation. They were probably not ready for the dollar number that I estimated the recovery at. So there was a degree of, well, we guessed it was going to be bad, Colin, but not quite that bad. So I remember sitting and discussing, you know, do we kind of try and sweeten this or do we hit them with the truth? In the end, we went for the latter. Now, that had to be backed up with a lot of data, of course. Was it challenged? Yes. So we had to point out, you know, very clearly where we're at and what the recovery needs to be. And then what the benefits will be from it. Have we lowered our operational running costs? Yes. Do we have very tight financial controls to measure that? Yes. If we're investing in IT, is it tracked closely? Yes. Do they come back and check on the benefits? You said you would be able to lower this. Yes, we do. We've been able to prove, you know, we've done what we said we do. Yes, it has cost some investment money, but we've had the returns from it. We track those with lots of metrics, prove that we are running IT more efficiently before. Something like networks, of course, there is typically, you know, the unit costs in networking fall year on year. But our networking costs have come down far more than the annual run rate. You know, as we've standardized it, we managed to lower the operational costs again. When we merged the data centers down, we've been able to prove that we've lowered run costs. We try and keep that message for first and foremost in the business's mind that they're getting a better service for less money. But yes, there was no way around the investment cost it was going to take. The good news, of course, was that the amount of work needed, it was clearly a multi-year program. And even if we'd asked for all the money immediately, we couldn't have dealt with it. We did manage to phase the funding. Although it was an unsavory and unpalatable number, we knew it was going to be spread over a 5-6 year period. The other news coming out of recession is you're going into a growth period. It's one of those, well, if you're coming out of a recession at whatever, 35 billion, it's going to cost you some money, but if you wait till you're 50, it's going to cost you even more. If you're in that growth scenario, then actually getting it done early, the early investment is the right strategy to go for. If you're in flat or declining, obviously it's a very different picture as to what you want to do with your IT investment.
You've mentioned a couple of times the Internet of Things or the Internet of Buildings as it applies to that part of your organization. This is a ascending trend. It's certainly getting a lot of ink in the usual suspect periodicals. And yours, it strikes me as an organization that's been thinking about this perhaps a bit longer than others because of the direct applicability to business lines of yours. And I wonder if you now have any opinions that you formulated by virtue of the benefits that you and your organization have garnered by leveraging the Internet of Things, by developing computing that is itself developing insights and value without human intervention, or at least not in the processing of that in order to develop those insights. What sorts of ideas do you have to share, especially perhaps to your peer group who may be further behind you in leveraging the power of the Internet of Things?
Everyone talks about the four trends, the social and the mobile and the cloud and of course, big data. Big data is going to get driven by the Internet of Things. That's what's going to drive our big data. I think it will be fundamental because the cost of now microprocessors is so low. The cost of IP enabling them is coming down at the same rate. It's not just our products. I mean, if you look at a car, typical models, mid-range might contain 60, 70 microprocessors. Top-end models, north of 100. So the computing capacity now that's available in a car is fairly phenomenal. And it's the next big consumer space. They've kind of got you at home with your internet connectivity and your cables and your satellite TV dishes and the rest of it. Now they want you at the car. You say the ability to stream movies, do email and do anything else you like in a car, that's coming, and you can see cars now, they're wireless hotspots already built in. So that connectivity, the Internet of Things, is coming. Obviously, the ability of automotive companies to pull data from their cars, the information is huge. Their only problem is how to deal with it all. Someone once described a modern aeroplane to me as a flying data center. You know, here's a question. I don't know. I don't work for Boeing. But, you know, how many terabytes of data does a single flight fly from New York to London? How many terabytes of data does that produce? The engines are streaming data real-time back to Rolls-Royce. I'm sure the aeroplane is streaming data back to Boeing. All of the devices are heading this way. Now, okay, a $100 million aeroplane can carry a heavy technology investment. Car, a little harder. You've got to get a different cost point for a $30,000 item. For us on a chiller, big chillers can be, you know, six-figure numbers. But even a smaller rooftop units, you know, you might be in a $10,000-$20,000. But the cost point for IT is coming down to the point where, you know, for a product in that cost range, you can easily justify the investment in internet connection. The benefits for us in terms of servicing, to be able to have your products no longer need planned and scheduled maintenance, but to be able to predict, I'm going to need an engineer next week, can you get one out here? Huge benefit in cost to us, huge benefit to customer in terms of service. Inevitably, the box is going to fail just after your scheduled maintenance call. Murphy's Law will apply. So, I mean, I think this area is going to be fundamental to the IT guys. So we're going to be dealing with vast amounts of data that are streaming in towards us from products rather than applications. Whereas in the past, our world has been one of, it's the apps that generate the data. And we get annoyed with the users as they store umpteen years of emails and they don't strip the attachments and the disk storage numbers double every year. And mercifully, the cost per gigabyte comes down. I mean, even the gigabyte is an outdated concept now. I think it's soon to fade from our language and the way that kilobytes have disappeared. And yeah, it's a 12 terabyte PC, isn't it? And people are going to start getting familiar with zettabytes and petabytes and yottabytes. So the data is just going to be huge. But for us, it's different because we're used to structured data from an application. We take our big SAP system and we know how to archive it down and we put the data over there and we control the disks and we try and manage that data storage growth. We know how to back it up and make copies and mirror things. It's going to be different now. So the data is going to be coming at us from outside the company, from our products mostly. We're going to have to find ways to manage that, control that. New tools will be needed to analyze the data and produce the management information. Going back to an SAP, you know, the ERP platforms, we've got their management reporting tools. I think, you know, that's well understood. In the big data world, it's going to be slightly different. And then the other thing I think is going to happen is, I think in-memory computing is coming. It's not just disk storage that's getting cheaper, it's in-memory, you know, chip storage that's getting cheaper. So architecturally, and we've been for the last 30 years splitting OLTP systems from our MIS systems. You know, rule one, do not let the users run some galactic report on your transactional system asking the history of everything. You know, you will pay the price in your online response system. So you design your transactional system to optimize transactions and your big reporting system, and you must separate them. I think that's going to go. I think, you know, architecturally in the future, the processing power that you get available within memory computing means that actually you can just stick it all in one. And you'll be able to still deliver that performance for online OLTP at the same time as you can deliver whatever MIS reporting capacity. And the last one I think that you're going to see in the area is, I think, the ability now to, for some of the kind of the big data-y converging platforms that's coming, the imperative to get down to, you know, one or two big transactional systems becomes less so. I mean, I'm still not advocating, you know, stick with 150, but, you know, if you can get down to a reasonable number, 5, 10, that kind of arena, I think the reporting tools that are becoming available mean that you can pull consistent reporting out from multiple transactional platforms quite efficiently, far easier than we ever used to do in the past where you had to map all of your data. So I think if that exercise gets easier, the answer is, well, should we consolidate those remaining systems down? No, it's actually getting more economic now to put a business intelligence, a BI tool over the top, because we can pull information out so easily. I think the imperative to consolidate is not going away, but it's lessening.
I want to briefly also cover your time at the nexus of the JV between Sony and Ericsson. You were the CIO of that joint venture. It's the center of two very different companies, culturally, history of what they developed and how they developed things, and two different ways of thinking about IT. And I know from our conversations that you were challenged to and challenged your colleagues to find new ways to do things that reflected the pace of change that was happening in that industry. And I wonder if you can talk just a bit about that.
Yeah, it was probably the most stressful time of my life. But looking back, it was interesting. I got this highly unusual request to drop whatever I was doing and get on a plane to Tokyo, which is very alarming because that's so un-Japanese. you know, normally everything there is planned well in advance. But, you know, the drop, what are you doing? Whatever you're doing, drop it. You've got to get to Tokyo and you've got to go and see this guy. So I discovered it was easy to work out where he was in the Sony organization, extremely high. So I'm sort of going over there, what have I done? So that was when you got the news of, okay, we're setting up a new JV with Ericsson and you're the CIO. So this is never, of course, in phrase as an opportunity that you have an opportunity to say yes or no to. This is the appropriate answer is thank you very much. And here we go. And then it was right, now get on a plane, go to Sweden. And I really hadn't spent much time in Sweden, so I didn't know the Swedes. I was very familiar with the Japanese culture after a number of years at Sony, but I had to learn Sweden. The essence of the two, you've got two very large parent companies operating multiple lines of business. Core business is a difficult definition for both of them. Both of them huge, very global, and they were looking to combine their two mobile phone businesses, both of which candidly were in trouble. Sony had always struggled to be a player. Ericsson had been number one. We always think of Nokia as dominant, and at the time they were, but prior to Nokia's dominance, the industry was really kind of started by Ericsson. So they were up at the top and had been struggling to compete. We had to put the two businesses together. Small team, there was about 14 of us, worked on the initial effort. The assumption was originally that we would either have our IT provided by Sony or by Ericsson. So the initial request to me was, Colin, please evaluate the IT platforms of the two parent companies and make recommendations as to which one. So I knew I was going to upset somebody. But in the end, as I got into it and started digging down into the mobile phone business, the answer was that neither was going to work. Little digression on mobile phones, you know, lifetime in the marketplace, 6 months. Opportunity to make money, first couple of months. Phone moves from being cool to something outdated that your kids would be embarrassed to be seen with in 6 months. Very fast moving. The technology was moving at a phenomenal rate. I mean, mean, when you see the early mobile phones the size of a half a dozen house bricks, a concrete block, and they weighed about as much. You know, every year, huge advances on the chip platforms, capabilities, the screens, the battery life. So it was a rapid moving market. The IT platforms for the two parent companies, it sounds like a criticism, but it's not. They were just large and monolithic. The procurement platform might be supporting 10 different businesses with 10 different CEOs in different markets. And if you wanted to change anything on that platform, full consensus was required in both companies. It's not that there was anything wrong with their IT. It was the IT that you would expect for multi-billion dollar global businesses that have been around for 40, 50 years or more. Too big, too slow. And the mechanisms that govern the change, too big, too slow. So the only way we were ever going to allow the JV to move at the speed it needed to have a chance of competing was to create its own IT that we could change at our will, at our speed. So in the end, I upset them by saying, actually, you know, we can't use either company's platform. We're going to have to build our own, which sounded like a huge investment cost that no one had been thinking about, which was partially true. But we didn't build from scratch. So I did inherit IT departments from Sony and Ericsson. We maybe touched on that one later. That was an interesting people experience. I looked in the end, we took more elements from Ericsson than Sony, but a bit of both. So we stole with pride from our parent companies, but we ripped them out, made copies, and separated them out such that the change management decisions were ours and ours alone. We weren't dependent on the parent companies. All we had to do was provide them, you know, the consolidated financial numbers at the end of the year, and they were happy. Speed was the imperative for us. We had to have an environment that we could make changes in very rapidly. That was the mantra that we had. I think we succeeded, but that's why we had to change it. The IT had to reflect that we were going to kind of compete in. Totally global, of course. Huge customers, T-Mobile. So by definition, everything was global. There were going to be no national variations in anything. So all the platforms immediately global from day one. And then, yeah, big build out in China where the manufacturing ended up.
What lessons did you take from that? You are in an industry now, you interact with a number of industries that are not nearly as fast paced, nor do the products that you are developing become commoditized quite as quickly as what you just described. But were there aspects of what you learned from this very unusual circumstance that you've taken with you now into your current job as well?
I'm a favor of quality over quantity. Give me 20 really good programmers over 100 kind of average every day of the week. You know, don't give me a basis team of 20, 30 people. Just give me 6 that are 7 that are really good. You know, going for quality and going for speed, we ran lean because we had to, so I was never going to get permission to to ramp up the headcount anyway, but I think it worked in our favor. So I like smaller, tighter teams, but get good people and fight with HR if you have to pay them what you need to keep. People were motivated. I've never found yet an IT department that's disinterested in the business. Everyone always has this view that, oh, we're an ivory tower and, you know, disconnected. If they are, it's only because the business disconnects them, right? But I still get surprised when, you know, business people, you invite them to an IT meeting, you know, town hall meeting. And why? Well, we want you to talk to them about a new marketing strategy or a new product lineup. The IT guy's interested in that. And you, yes, absolutely they are. They want to know what's going on. They want to be part of the business. So you still kind of have to deal with that one. Speed, communication, and communication and communication. When you're looking to make change, the question is, by what degree are you going to under-communicate? You can't overdo it. And the other one, I guess I learned, was how fast things fall away from the head office. And by that, I mean, if you're in the head office, well, everyone knows that. Well, yeah, everyone knows that. Yeah, we're going to standardize on Cisco routers or whatever. Everyone knows that. As you move away from the head office, what you take for granted that every fool must know that by now. There can't be anyone left in a company who's unaware. Wrong. Once you get out into the provinces, they have no idea. And you think, well, hang on, we're the IT department. We should be masters of telephones and email and chat. All of the modern communication tools that you put in place in a company. How is it that, you know, half the IT function seems to have no idea what the strategy is? Spend a lot of time on road shows, just going round and round. Be very consistent in a message. Repeat it till you are bored hearing yourself saying the same thing. But at least you're consistent and you have to get it through. Never underestimate how little people understand English, even though you think they do. You can have a conversation with the one-to-one. You think you've been clear and you haven't. even if you avoided all the let's grasp the bull by the horns and it's a jump ball situation and you try and avoid all of those things that really aren't going to translate into Chinese. In Asia, we used to have rules on how many words were allowed on any one PowerPoint slide. Had to do pictures. Not because they're stupid, just because the picture conveys the message and the words don't. If you have the long, wordy English slides, it's fine if you're English or American, but you rapidly tail off as soon as you're into any other culture. So you have to make that translatable. And then someone said to me once, didn't understand it in the early days, that you know, if technology clashes with culture, culture will win. So you have to understand the culture of, in our case with the JV, the culture we're trying to create that had to be different to the two parent companies. In Johnson Controls, that's a 125-year-old company with a definite culture. You have to work with that. So it's learning how to bend your desire for uniformity and standardization with, yeah, we're going to have to kind of do that slightly differently in order to either meet a country's culture, the company culture that you operate in. And even though we have an overarching company culture that's quite definable, each of our business units has a subculture that's very different. Largely, I believe, and this is just my speculation, driven by the customer base that they serve. So if you like the market that they operate in, I don't think it's personalities or people within JCI. My view is the characteristics are driven by the marketplace you operate in.
Well, Colin Boyd, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing your perspectives from across a variety of different experiences and the many things that have made you a successful IT executive. It's been a great conversation.
Been a pleasure.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.